Hello, this is Beverly Tomasi, and welcome to our Diabetes Fundamentals. We'll be talking about nutrition and exercise today, and nutrition and exercise is a cornerstone of diabetes education that patients really rely on to help improve their quality of life and also to get their blood glucose levels to target. I'm a diabetes educator and a registered nurse, and even though I'm not a dietitian, as a CDE, we are compelled to discuss nutrition therapy with our clients because we need to be familiar with a wide breadth of information regarding diabetes. So as I go through this today, we'll be talking about nutrition as a certified diabetes educator, but certainly to know that dietitians are an excellent place to refer patients to get further in-depth information, and that we really need to include the entire team as part of this conversation. And certainly if you have access to physical therapists are another excellent resource to help patients get a grasp on exercise and provide exercise strategies to succeed. And so what we'll be talking about today are the nutrition guidelines as published by the American Diabetes Association. We'll be looking at those recommendations that were updated in 2013 and still hold true today. So there was a big revision of the recommendations to 2013 that have really, I think, improved the science and the relationship between what we tell our patients. We'll look at teaching strategies. You know, one of the hardest things to change for people living with diabetes or without diabetes for that matter is how we eat. So altering our food relationships and timing of food is very difficult. So as we move forward with patients on helping them to eat more healthfully, definitely we need to be mindful and respectful of their preferences and cultural issues and how they usually live their daily lives. We'll look at exercise. What are the goals for people with diabetes? How do we do it safely? And how do we incorporate strength training into our conversation? And so when we think about people and working with people with diabetes, we're kind of, you know, looking into their pantry and seeing what's in there as we sit down with them and discuss their dietary habits and activity levels. So what's in your pantry is kind of our question. I've listed a bunch of resources for you. There's an exchange list on your resource page in your student center. An exchange list just talks about the major types of foods and how much is one serving of carbohydrate, a serving of fat, a serving of protein. And so you want to be familiar with these if you're teaching any patient about carb counting, or if you're thinking about taking the CDE exam, you want to be familiar with that exchange list. Also, the ADA standards of care, I would definitely take a look at those. If you look at standard 4, it talks about nutrition therapy recommendations, and then there's also recommendations on exercise and type 2 diabetes. The American College of Sports Medicine and the American Diabetes Association did put together a joint position statement regarding exercise that it's really detailed and it outlines very clearly the benefits and goals of exercise. So if you think about our patients and losing weight, man, it's a real challenge. So many of our patients with diabetes, especially type 2, are overweight, probably about 90% of them. And I can guarantee you they've tried to lose weight many times in their life, and they've really had trouble succeeding at weight loss, and they may lose the weight and the weight comes back. So this relationship with a scale is not a good one, and they're always trying to bring that weight down. And so as we move forward with them, you know, we're going to really look at what their past successes have been and incorporate that into our recommendations at the present. Obesity in America is a real issue. So this chart looks at the relationship between education and obesity, and you can see if it's less than a high school education, they have the highest rates of obesity. Over here is BMI, and over here is a timeline. So starting in 1986, you could see for less than high school education, we had an average BMI of 25. And now in 2012, that BMI is approaching 29. But the educated that go to college are also increasing their BMI from 24 in 1986 all the way up to 27 in 2012. So all of us are getting heavier regardless of our education level. 68% of Americans currently are obese or overweight. 34% are obese with a BMI of 30 or greater, and the other 34% have BMIs of 25 to 29, which is the overweight category. And so this is a real issue as we work with our clients that are struggling with their weight. And also, we're seeing a lot more adolescents with type 2 diabetes because of this obesity issue. And a lot of actually our type 1s are getting heavier too, and they're really struggling with insulin resistance associated with that extra body weight. Interestingly enough, a lot of my patients say, "Well, Bev, I know why I have diabetes. It's because I'm overweight or obese." But here's a really important bullet point. One third of all people who are overweight don't get diabetes. So in order to get diabetes, you have to have several things happening. Number one is a genetic risk. And then the genetic risk plus the environmental influences increase or decrease your risk of diabetes. So if you have the genetic risk and you live in a situation where there's not a lot of healthy foods or it's a, dangerous environment to get out and exercise, you may be at a higher risk for becoming overweight and expressing the diabetes. And certainly, if you read the literature now, it definitely is saying we live in an obesogenic environment. And that is, we don't live in an environment that supports health. We live in an environment that supports gaining excess weight. And if you walk into any liquor store, you'll certainly see that's the case. I ask my kids, like, when you walk into a liquor store, what do you see? And what you see? Candies, chips, sodas, the first three things. And none of those offer good nutrient value or fiber or really anything that we need to consume. So we need to really think about, in order to reduce this epidemic of obesity, is creating environments that support health, not obesity. We move around a lot less. When you think about this, if you think about your grandmother, how many hours a day did your grandmother sit down? My grandmothers each had nine children, and they did not sit down. Maybe after the kids moved out, they might have sat down. But nowadays, we're sitting an average of 9.5 hours a day, 9 hours a day of sitting. And that certainly is wreaking havoc on our body weight and our overall health. So I'm sure you've heard that sitting is the new smoking. The more we sit, the more visceral adiposity we accumulate, and the more insulin resistant we become from that visceral adiposity. So the American Diabetes Association is saying get up and move every 90 minutes. Really important. The other thing is that food costs less relative to income. So as we've industrialized food, it's costing less to manufacture and distribute. So a person who has a lower income can still get enough calories and maybe more calories than they need. And many times people on limited incomes will eat a large amount of food when they have the money, worried about not having access to money and food in the future. Our calorie intake is on the rise. Here in 1970, we were eating an average of 2,000 calories a day. By the year 2010, we're up to 2,600 calories a day. So certainly more caloric intake than we need to sustain our current energy output. And that's one of the resulting reasons of this overweight and obesity trend. So we're struggling. America has tried, we've actually kind of stopped the growth of obesity. We're holding still, but we need to move it down the other way. And Mexico is struggling with the same thing. And actually, Mexico imposed a sugar tax for sodas. And they are seeing a really improvement in the community drinking less sodas and improving their overall intake of water. We'll talk about that in a minute. Here's a BMI chart. I have this posted in my office. You can just Google BMI charts, but you can see here the left side looks at the height, and then here's the weight, and it looks at BMI. So a BMI less than 24.9 is considered normal. When the BMI is 25 to 29.9, we're overweight, and then BMI of 30 or greater is considered obese. So as I sit down with my clients, I ascertain their height, their weight, and then I let them know what their BMI is and what the significance of that is. And then I do say, we consider a BMI of 25 or less to be normal weight, and I show them where that would be. I mean, we have to use our discrepancy because if I have a patient who weighs 300 pounds, I may not show them a BMI of 25. It may seem overwhelming to them. So I just may talk about losing 5% of their body weight. So it kind of depends on your client and what what you're trying to encourage with them. So we don't want our patients to feel so discouraged looking at where they should be versus where they're at, but it might give us a reference point for some of our patients. I like this visual image of BMI. And so here you can see a BMI of 17.5 or more toward the underweight category, 18 to 22 normal, moving to 25. So 25 BMI here would be highest normal. So you can see as the person here moves from a BMI of 22 to 25, there's more additional visceral adiposity or weight gain around the middle. And actually, for Asians, a BMI of 23 or greater puts them at higher risk for diabetes, because for the Asian population, when they gain weight, they tend to put it centrally or gain it abdominally or viscerally, and that puts them at higher risk for diabetes at a lower BMI. And so I like this chart as a real great visualization, because when you start getting the BMI above 25 and more toward 30, toward obesity, you can see that there's increase in adipose tissue around the middle there. And that increased adipose tissue around the middle increases insulin resistance, inflammation, and if you have the genetic risk, certainly increases the risk for diabetes. So when you look at the risk factors for diabetes, it's genetics and obesity are the type two that really drive the expression of diabetes. So let's do a poll question. For an overweight patient with new type 2 diabetes, what would be appropriate nutrition goal? So this overweight patient, newly diagnosed, would it be A, avoid all desserts and processed foods? Would it be B, try to lose 5 to 10% of current body weight? Would it be C, eat less than 7% saturated fat? D, eat breakfast? Or E, avoid sugary beverages? So there's more than one right answer here. I'll just take a second and you can take a look at this and think about what would be some appropriate nutrition goals for this person. All right, well, let's go through these together. So A, avoid all desserts and processed foods. Many people choose this answer, but it's actually not the right answer, and I'll tell you why. Because this word here, all. So anytime we tell somebody, or if you're taking the test and it says avoid all desserts and processed foods, that's what I call a perfect score. And it says, if you translate it over, you can never eat desserts and processed foods again. That is not a realistic expectation, and it's not based in science. So now what we say to people with diabetes is, instead of avoid all desserts, we may say make desserts a special treat. Make processed food a special treat. So the general message is eat less of it. That's a very important message, because when we get into this situation where we say don't eat this, it goes into the deprivation mode, and a lot of people feel that, well, if you're telling me I can't eat it, I want it even more. So we want to decrease that feeling and say there's no food that's bad. You just want to eat less of certain foods. B, try to lose 5 to 10% of current body weight. Yes, that is the right answer. So we know, regardless of how overweight you are, if you can lose 5% of your body weight, you can reduce your risk of getting diabetes, A, and if you already have diabetes, it can really protect your beta cells. So if you weigh 200 pounds, 5% of 200 pounds is 10 pounds, and that would be a starting goal for people. So that's another way of helping people figure out, where do I need to go from here? No matter how overweight a person is, weight loss matters, even if it's 5%. C, eat less than 7% saturated fat. Is that a right answer? Actually, no. The American Diabetes Association updated their recommendations recently, and now what we say is eat less than 10% saturated fat. It used to be 7%, but with the new guidelines, we're saying let's just match it up to what the general public recommendations are and strive for less than 10%. D, eat breakfast. Is that right? Absolutely. There's lots of studies that show eating breakfast helps people with weight management. It helps with blood sugar regulation, because when we skip breakfast and we have our first meal later in the day, we tend to eat more calories to compensate for that. And also, I notice a lot of people, when they skip breakfast, their blood sugars go a little bit higher. And I think it's because the liver is releasing glucose because there's no food coming in. So the liver goes into hyperdrive and releases glucose, and that's why those morning blood sugars are so high many times when they skip breakfast. So eat breakfast is correct, and then E, avoid sugary beverages, another correct answer. So it doesn't say here never drink sugary beverages or avoid all sugary beverages. It just says avoid. So that gives us a little leeway. Drink less sugary beverages is really a very important recommendation. I personally would like to say avoid all sugary beverages for the rest of your life. Even better, I would like to say, let's get rid of sugary beverages, but it's probably not going to happen during my lifetime. So that kind of is just setting up our framework for the rest of this presentation. And now when we sit down with our patient to assess knowledge and self-management skills, we're going to ask them questions like, tell me how you eat. And I often ask my patients, tell me when is your first meal of the day. I don't use the word breakfast because many times patients, I don't know, that it's confusing to them because they don't eat a traditional breakfast. So I say, tell me when is your first meal, your second meal, and your last meal of the day. And what time is it? So I want to get a sense of time. I want to get a sense of portions, snacks. What is their eating environment? Are they eating and watching television? Are they eating in a quiet space? And then I'm going to just have my feelers out for any disordered eating, especially if I'm noticing some patterns that indicate that, and we'll talk about that more later. The medical nutrition therapy guidelines from the American Diabetes Association now say there is no ideal percentage of calories from protein, carbohydrate, and fat for people with diabetes. Oh, okay, so that's pretty vague because we like numbers and patients like numbers. They want to know, well, how much should I eat of fat and protein and carbohydrate? But the American Diabetes Association says, you know what, we have to individualize it. There's no one right recipe for all people. We have to look at their eating patterns, their preferences, and what are their goals. And based on that, we're going to make calculations. And I really think that's where the dietitians come in. Their specialty practice focuses on that. So as diabetes educators, we're going to give them these general recommendations. And if we're a dietitian or we have, we're going to work with a dietitian in our team, we want to make sure that they meet with this patient to really hone in on their individual meal plan, which is really important. So the goals of medical nutrition therapy, we now know there's no recommendation for each of the macronutrients, but here are the recommendations to promote and support healthful eating patterns. A, emphasize eating a variety of nutrient-dense foods in appropriate proportion. Well, it doesn't say proportion, but portions. So portion size is a big deal. And nutrient-dense, a really important concept that we want to make sure people are eating foods that are rich in nutrition. So that's where, the soda issue comes up because sodas obviously are just sugar and water and additives. It doesn't provide nutrition for our body. We want to look to attain blood pressure, blood glucose, and lipid goals. So food is therapeutic. Food is a therapeutic intervention that not only helps blood sugars, but blood pressure and lipids. We want to look at what are their body weight goals. And so this is a conversation we have with the patient. What are you trying to work toward? What's reasonable for you as far as getting to your body weight, and how can we achieve that together? And then we really want to help them delay or prevent complications. We're going to address the individual nutrition needs based on personal and cultural preferences. Wow, this is really important. In the old days when I first started in diabetes education, I would encourage patients to stop the way they were eating and move over to my way. It never worked. So I learned a lot. I learned the most from my patients, actually. And so now I say, tell me how you're eating and let's make some small changes to help you succeed. And then after people do well with small changes, they can take on bigger changes. It's pretty amazing. They build their self-confidence. We want to look at their access to food. Can they afford it? I just, met with a gal and I said, how do you buy food? And she has food stamps. That's her only way she gets food. So we have to work within the context of their life. And then we have to look at their willingness and barriers. And barriers can be emotional barriers, financial barriers. So we want to, during our assessment, find out about these things. Look at this. Maintain pleasure of eating by providing positive messages about food. That is so important. So many of our people with diabetes come in and they're filled with shame. They think that it's the way they're eating that's causing their diabetes, or they cause a diabetes in the way they've been eating, or they're overweight or obese. So we really want to help build a positive relationship with food and take away that feeling of deprivation and really only limit food choices when backed by science. And then providing practical day-to-day planning. I think that's really important. Practical information to help them succeed as opposed to just focusing on protein, fat, and carbs and carb counting. How can they improve their health practically day to day? So when you think about what Medicare covers, so this is important for our practice and for the exam, of course, but Medicare covers 3 hours of nutrition therapy in the first calendar year. And dietitians have been shown to be wildly effective at lowering A1Cs. An intervention with a dietitian can lower an A1C by 1% for people with type 1 diabetes and up to 2% A1C drop, which is 60 points blood sugar drop for people with type 2 diabetes. So this is such an important resource for our patients, yet only 10% of people with diabetes ever see a dietitian. And that's just wrong. And so we can be an advocate to make sure that our patients are referred to the dietitian and take advantage of that wonderful service. In addition to the first calendar year, they get 2 hours of annual follow-up. To be reimbursed, you must be recognized by the American Diabetes Association or AADE. So that's part of their reimbursement for diabetes education, medical nutrition therapy. So our approach depends on our patient. If a patient comes in with new type 2, we're going to have a conversation about their goals. And many times when I meet with patients and they're overweight, one of their main goals is to lose weight. And so we're going to go on that journey with them. And we're going to ask them, tell me what has succeeded with you in the past as far as weight loss strategies. And then we're going to look at portion control, maybe the plate method, keeping records. So anybody who keeps a record of what they're eating, really loses weight. I mean, lots of studies have shown that if you write down everything you eat and do it honestly, it changes behavior. So if you don't want to write it down, a lot of patients are now taking photos of their food, which I think is a great idea, and they can just document through their phone what they're eating. And then, of course, I'm getting them the education and resources. Now, what if they're on insulin? Insulin's a little bit different approach because now we have to match carbohydrates to an injection of insulin. And we definitely want to make sure that there's enough carbohydrates to match the insulin they're taking. And they need to know what foods are carbohydrates. So we're going to be more intensive on our education for our patients with type 1 because they're more insulin sensitive. For our type 2s, we may keep it a little bit more global. But certainly we want to emphasize the point that if you're going to take insulin, you need carbohydrates to match with that. If a patient's telling you, yeah, I just take my insulin and they eat some cheese, cheese is a protein-fat combination. It won't sustain their blood sugar. So this is where we start making the connections with them that you need to have this interaction between carbohydrate and insulin. As far as sodium, fat, and fiber, the sodium is the same as a general population, less than 2,300 milligrams a day. And so most of our salt comes from, it's not the table salt that we, the salt shaker, it comes from processed foods. So it's really the processed packaged foods that contain the most salt out there. So really taking a look at that. Vitamins and mineral supplements, not recommended. There's no good evidence that support that they improve outcomes. And I just want to say for a lot of my patients, their limited income, these are expensive. These supplements cost a lot of money. And so I want to make sure that they understand that and that they can move their money into maybe more basic needs. As far as fat, here's the fat recommendations, same as the general population. Less than 10% from saturated fat and limit trans fats, less than 300 milligrams of cholesterol a day. And moving more toward a plant-based diet and Mediterranean diet seems to be a good option to improve cholesterol levels and outcomes. Fiber, a big deal. So fiber, 25 to 38 grams a day. I think the average American gets about 10 grams of fiber a day. And so we want to help patients look at labels and identify which foods are high in fiber and consume more of those. Actually, it's the foods that oftentimes don't have labels that are higher in fiber, like what I have listed here. So choose healthy, high-fiber carbohydrates. Carbs that have fiber, vitamins, minerals, and phytonutrients are the best choices. And that includes beans, veggies, with that non-soluble fiber. So foods that have non-soluble fibers, especially from vegetables, really help to feed our good gut bacteria. And as you know, our good gut bacteria really help prevent against disease and help with digestion and seem to decrease inflammation. And so these vegetables really are, especially onions, artichokes, tomatoes, garlic, Brussels sprouts, really seem to feed our good gut bacteria. Fruit and whole grain foods. Really moving toward those whole grain foods can help a lot. Get that fiber up. I talk about this a lot in my with my patients, and it's a struggle because we've moved away from fiber, moved back to the fiber. The other thing I do talk about is sugar intake. The average American consumes currently 22 teaspoons of sugar a day, and that rate has doubled and tripled over the past 50 years. So we're just consuming way too much sugar, way more than we need. You could probably live just fine without any sugar, but we're just overconsuming it. There has been throughout in California and other states warning labels on sodas proposed that says warning sodas can lead to obesity and diabetes and other problems. That hasn't passed a legislation yet because, as you know, the soda companies are very well off and fight against it. But there's momentum gathering. One soda has 12 teaspoons of sugar. And on average, one person consumes 40 gallons of soda a year. Now, why you say, why are we picking on soda? Well, because soda is seems to be one of the leading causes of the increasing obesity problems. And it seems that soda in particular seems to increase visceral adiposity. And I just read a great article saying that soda and increased intake of sugar increases is actually leading and supporting our increased risk of fatty liver disease. So fatty liver disease is on the rise. The World Health Organization has finally kind of stepped in here and said, we've got to do something about this sugar intake throughout the world. Let me just give you some soda facts. According to Harvard researchers, drinking 1 to 2 sugary beverages per day increases a person's risk of developing type 2 diabetes by 26%. And Mexico, as I mentioned, started their soda tax in 2014, and the consumption of sugary beverages fell 10% in 3 months, and people drank more water and milk. And I just read an update to the soda tax, and they're actually going to increase it even more because they found that the soda tax benefited people with the least amount of income the most. So, I mean, we can see when we add costs to things, people consume them less. The same thing happened with cigarettes. And if we're thinking about this from a public health perspective, maybe this will really make a difference. Drinking a 20-ounce soda a day was equivalent to reducing the average life expectancy by 4.6 years. This is a study done by UCSF that looked at the telomeres in the cells, and the telomeres are kind of a predictor of life expectancy, and they were shortened for with soda drinkers. The World Health Organization says we should reduce daily free sugar, so this is that white sugar or added sugar intake, to around 12 teaspoons. Ideally, it should be less than 6 teaspoons or less than 5%. So there is movement, and I think we can be a part of this as diabetes educators and health advocates to say, let's take a critical look at where we're getting this sugar and see if we can't help inform people about limiting that. So when we meet with our patients to teach about healthy eating, if they're overweight, we're certainly going to talk about portion control. And if they have type 1 diabetes, we might focus more on the carbohydrate counting. But there's different methods. There's a plate method, exchange list, food diaries. So we want to assess what is best for the situation. And let's just talk about some different strategies. One thing I generally start out with my patients, and it kind of depends on the patient and where they're at, but I want to tell them move toward the tomato. So here's a continuum of food. On this side is Twinkies, processed food, food you get through a window. This is what we want to eat less of. So less processed food and more toward whole food, foods from the earth, foods that aren't processed, nuts, whole grains, vegetables, fruits. That's what we want. These foods offer us much more in the way of phytonutrients, and they help replenish our good bacteria and feed our good bacteria. So we really want to encourage our patients to move in this direction. And then I have a cup of coffee here. Why do I have coffee? Well, coffee is always controversial, but some of the latest research I've been reading is that if you don't have diabetes, drinking 2 cups of coffee a day can help prevent diabetes. So coffee is looking pretty good currently. And when they talk about moving toward the tomato with my patients, moving more toward the whole grains, fruits, vegetables, that's going to support weight loss. And the truth is, losing weight, especially early in diagnosis of type 2 diabetes, is really helpful for our patients. 2 to 8 kilogram weight loss can make a big difference when you lose that visceral adiposity, because early weight loss, you do lose a lot of that visceral fat. It makes your beta cells work better, and they don't have to fight against insulin resistance as much. But to lose 1 pound is hard. You have to avoid 3,500 calories. So just to put that in perspective, 500 calories is a sandwich. So you would have to eat 7 less sandwiches to lose 1 pound. And that's not easy. If anybody is listening here, has tried to lose weight, or you've coached people to lose weight, eating less is really difficult to do and to sustain. But we do want to encourage it and then add on exercise. Now, exercise by itself doesn't cause weight loss, but exercise does support keeping the weight off. So here's some successful weight loss strategies. We want to base our recommendations on science. So what does the science say that helps people succeed? Well, weighing themselves at least once a week is really helpful. Eating breakfast, reduce fast food. And this is not, rocket science. It's basic stuff, but it's worth going over with our patient. Eating less fast food. So what if they eat out at McDonald's 7 days a week? We're not going to necessarily say you can never eat out at McDonald's, but we might want to say, hey, tell me what you eat there, and let's help them make healthier choices and say, instead of 7 days a week, can we go to what, 3 days a week? We have to negotiate this with them. And then if they're not going to go and eat fast food, what can they eat instead? So we have to kind of think about all these, the barriers, and if they're not going to eat this, what can they eat in its place? Decreasing portion size, moving from a 13-inch plate to a 9-inch plate, getting active. Maybe they use meal replacement so they have a predictable calorie source for breakfast or for lunch, and that way they can control at least that portion. And then eating healthy foods. Bariatric surgery is recommended by the American Diabetes Association and the American Association of Clinical Endocrinology as a potential interventions for adults with diabetes with a BMI of 35 or greater, usually classified as morbidly obese. Now, this gut surgery, actually, by rerouting the stomach and bypassing the duodenum, it increases gut hormone availability. So when you increase gut hormone availability, like the GLP and the GIP, blood sugars go down immediately, even before weight loss. So when you look at who does best with bariatric surgery in terms of their diabetes improvement, it's people who have had diabetes for a short period of time where they have more beta cell mass. Now, it is true that after bariatric surgery, within 5 years, 68% of people with diabetes are in remission. And let me describe what remission means. It means the blood glucose levels are normal without medication. So it doesn't mean a cure. It doesn't mean the diabetes has gone away. It just means that their blood sugars are normal without medication. And that's really important to keep in mind, because a lot of people get misinformation about bariatric surgery. Now, if they gain the weight, or if they had very poor beta cell mass to begin with, they may not have that good of success. Their success may be less. But 35% within 5 years redevelop diabetes. So certainly, if you've watched people with bariatric surgery, some of them regain the weight. And if they regain the weight, their expression of diabetes is oftentimes, their diabetes is re-expressed and their blood sugars go up. So long-term benefits still under investigation. There's still a lot to learn about bariatric surgery and its long-term consequence. Now, myplate.gov is another way of looking at eating healthfully. And so MyPlate.gov is a good getting started place for a lot of our patients. I don't personally use this very much because there's a plate I'll show you in the next section where I really do appreciate that plate a little bit better. But I do like some of what it says here. Enjoy your food, but eat less. Don't oversize, so get that 9-inch plate. Don't go back for seconds. Make half your plate fruits and vegetables. So I like just saying load up half your plate with veggies and salad and all that different color of a variety of vegetables, and then make at least half your grains whole grains. And it talks about milk, going to low fat or fat-free milk. And then looking at foods to reduce, like sodium and soup, bread, and frozen meals, and choose foods with lower numbers and drinking water instead of sugary drinks. Okay, so what we did is we split this presentation in two. So this concludes the first section of this presentation. And now if you go into your related materials, you'll see the second session of this program on nutrition and exercise. So I'll close now and just go to your related materials tab, and then you can click on the second part of this presentation. Thank you so much for joining us. This concludes our first session, our first part of this session. Thank you.